There you go. Let me give that to you. Okay. So, my name is Jordy Izzard, and I am here today with Ambassador Nicholas Platt, who graduated from SAIS in the class of 1959, has been since then all around the world. Today's date is April 8th, 2011. And we're just gonna have a conversation today. I'm gonna ask you some questions, and thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay, so the first question is, just in thinking back, what originally brought you to SAIS?
Paul Nitzer brought me to SAIS.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I knew Paul Nitzer from my college days. His son was a roommate of mine. Not a roommate, but a classmate of mine. And I wanted to get some advice from him as to what I should do about going into the Foreign Service and what SAIS had to do with that, and was that relevant, and how would he advise me? And he said, well, if you can get into the Foreign Service, you should do so as soon as possible, because they will train you on the spot. But if you take your Foreign Service exams and you don't get through, come and see me. Mm-hmm. And I took my Foreign Service exams in the spring of my senior year at Harvard, and I did not pass. And so then I went to see him. And he was welcoming, and I had decent grades and so on and so forth, and he arranged for me to talk to the academic people at SAIS, who felt that my economic background was not very good, and advised me to read economics during the summer and so on and so forth, and then come and see them in the fall. And I did all that, and I went to SAIS. By that time, I was married, and my wife and I moved to Georgetown, where the housing was available. And then I went to SAIS every day, and the Nitzers were very welcoming. They were good mentors, and they had been friends of our family for years and years and years, and we became friends of theirs, and we used to go out to their farm on the weekends and so on and so forth. But that was what brought me to SAIS. He was one of these, you know, amazing, towering, you know, intellectual, foreign policy intellectuals who, when he was not in a government job, was at the SAIS, or at SAIS of the center. He was one of the founders of SAIS, of course. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard of SAIS and wouldn't have if it hadn't been for him. But he advised me to come there. He said that SAIS's location in Washington made it a great place to learn about the foreign policy establishment and about policy making in the United States. And as he was one of the practitioners, I was drawn to that. So that's what brought me to SAIS.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And then when you were at Harvard, had you focused on international affairs? Did it start earlier?
Yes, I had. I came when I was at Harvard. I did a summer in London as a Winant volunteer, which brought me overseas, representing United States' point of view in a completely different culture, which was not standard UK. It was the Jewish Cockney culture in the East End of London, and I enjoyed it very much. And I wondered what the kind of adult analog of this was. And these kids were badgering me incessantly about what I was going to do, because in the British system, they all made up their mind a lot earlier. I was 19 at the time. So I came back from my junior year at Harvard thinking that the Foreign Service was going to be for me. and took German, and I thought I'd be a Europeanist. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I went into, I took my first Foreign Service exams, passed the writtens, and then the orals were more of a challenge because, one, I was barely 21, and two, I didn't know anything about economics. And they found that out right away. And they were looking for reasons to make me come back again. Mm-hmm. And so they said, we can't take you. No, you have to take the whole thing over again. And I got the impression that they really wanted to be convinced that I wanted to do this. Mm-hmm. But by the time the next year I came back and I had enrolled in SAIS and I had taken, I'd worked in a brokerage house to get some practical economic background, mm-hmm. and I had studied economics and so forth, and I was married and had a child, mm-hmm. and they thought, well, maybe this is a serious person, so I passed the exam, and my chance to get into the Foreign Service coincided with the very end of my SAIS career. You know, you have to go through all these medical exams and security exams, and they have to figure out how to appropriate the money to hire you. Mm-hmm. So it was April of 1959 that the call came from the Foreign Service. So I finished up my graduate degree, my thesis, and went to Foreign Service boot camp at Arlington Towers all at the same time. In April, May, June of 59.
That's a big year.
Big year.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your memories while you were at SAIS. Do you remember professors or historical moments or?
Oh yes, you know, SAIS in those days was a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. There were 75 students. The limitation was dictated by the capacity of two old houses next to each other on Florida Avenue. That was where the school was. And it had, it was sort of old and rickety and friendly. Because the library space was limited, the focus at the school was really on how you could do live research with government officials and foreign policy practitioners. Mm-hmm. And so you were graded in your papers and things like that on, not on footnotes from books, but on interviews that you'd had with significant people who understood the foreign policy process. Mm-hmm. So this got us around town and into very rather high offices because of Paul Nitzer and Chris Herder and the other founders of SAIS, access was quite possible for any serious person. And we worked with some practitioners, people like Roger Hilsman, who was head of intelligence and research, and then later East Asian Affairs in the State Department. And I was one of his research assistants at one point. And we learned a lot about how decisions were made. Yeah. And I was taking more German, and I was taking more European history and things like that. I had not gotten interested in Asia. That came later. But there were some extraordinarily striking professors. One of them was Paul Linebarger, who was a China hand, but who also taught something called psychological warfare, mm-hmm. which was a course that I enjoyed very much, and he taught me a lot of things about the subliminal side of foreign policy and presenting oneself and making one's point and so on and so forth. And he also took his students out to have Chinese meals, but that was not what I was there for at that time, I thought. We had excellent teachers, Professor Tucker was the one who did all the lectures on Europe. Mm-hmm. And I remember his climactic lecture on the end of World War II on a spring afternoon. And as he came to the end and sort of to the climax of the series, the ceiling fell down. And it's an old, you know, building, and it was quite dramatic. And one guy was in the way of some falling plaster and had to be carted off. And it was a striking moment.
Sure.
But the school was small, and everybody knew each other, and it hadn't, you know, gone into the big time yet, although the quality of the teaching was very, very high. Mm-hmm. We had people like Hans Morgenthau to give lectures, and others who came in, you know, after hours. Mm-hmm. And I actually did that later on, after I had become a practitioner, and mm-hmm. I taught a course there back in 1969.
What did you teach?
Internal Chinese politics.
Mm-hmm. So, and do you remember anything else, or are those your memories of being there?
Well, Nietzsche himself was a force, mm-hmm. and I got a good feel for the way Washington actually worked. I think it's very hard to do that without actually living there, and I think that's always been one of the great strong points of Sices, its location mm-hmm. On the spot mm-hmm. in the place where all of this is done.
Sure. And tell us a little bit about after 59 was a big year for you. How did your career launch, and what did you do in your career?
Well, you know, I got into the Foreign Service, and as I was telling you, I was under a lot of pressure mm-hmm. trying to get finished with what I was doing at Sison, going to the A-100 course. And at the A-100 course, you get your first assignment. My first assignment was Windsor, Ontario. And I had, you know, put in for a European post. I thought that my work at Harvard and having passed the Foreign Service exam in German and so on and so forth would qualify me for some kind of, for what my sights were set on, which was to be a kind of a cold warrior in Europe. But the powers that be had other thoughts, and the idea of going to Windsor, Ontario, due south of Detroit, and issue visas and so forth was a subject of hilarity amongst all of my colleagues, they just thought that was the funniest thing that they'd ever heard, and I was quite upset. Mm. But in retrospect, it was a very beneficial assignment. First of all, the actual assignment itself, the process, taught me a very, very important truth about working in the government, is that people in the personnel departments of it really don't care what you already know. And the only way that you can add a rudder to your career is to convince them to train you in something that's really interesting and really expensive. And so this was what I drew from this. When I was at the Foreign Service Institute, sort of moping around and bewailing my fate and taking the jibes of my colleagues who were going off to Isfahan and Yaoundé and places like that, much more romantic and dramatic and so forth, I ran into a person I knew at Harvard who had been in the Foreign Service for a few years, and I asked him what he was doing there, and he said, I'm studying Chinese. Oh, I said, that's interesting. Why are you doing that? And this was 1959, and the Great Leap Forward was failing, and there was evidence of famine in China and tension with the Russians and so on and so forth. And I said, but, you know, there's no posts. I mean, you can't go anywhere. You can go to Hong Kong, you can go to Taiwan, He said, that doesn't matter. The long term is for us to have a relationship with them. This person himself was Jewish, and he said, you know, the East Asia Bureau is really the bureau in the State Department. It doesn't have any prejudice against Jews. And I was not a Jew, but I was very interested in that point that he made.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he was an accomplished bureaucrat, and he said, if you are interested in doing this, you should put in for it before you go away to Windsor. Before you go to Windsor, just go and say, I want to do this. And don't say, I'm thinking about it. Say, I want to do it. And I went and did that, knowing full well that I hadn't made my mind up, but I would have some time to do that. And it was... The people at personnel training and so forth laughed at me. I said, you know, why would we train you? I mean, you're just a wet behind the ears, brand new Foreign Service officer, etc. And I said, well, get used to my face, because I'm going to keep coming back until you know, get used to this idea. Well, I went off to Windsor, and Windsor was a small post, and it had a visa section of which I was the number two, and the number one was an old guy who was sort of coasting towards the end of his career, and so I ran pretty much the whole thing. It was very varied visa issuance, immigrants, non-immigrants, from every nationality, of course, Canada being a polyglot country, and so I really had to learn the immigration laws cold. Mm-hmm. And I did that. And I also learned quite a lot about Canada, and I learned a great deal about the Midwest of the United States, which was where I was, and the great companies of the Midwest for whom I was supplying workers. And so while it was not one of the world's great Foreign Service posts, it was where you ended or you began your career. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, prosaic beyond belief. I really learned a lot from it. And my bosses were all happy to have someone who really wanted to do the work and so forth. And so they gave me good fitness reports. And by the end of the 2 years there,
mm-hmm.
The training people said, all right, you can take Chinese. And by that time, I had read a lot about China in the 2 years that I'd been in Windsor. And both my wife and I were very, very anxious to do this. So we went into the language training program, which was a year in Washington and a year in Taiwan. And we came out, graduated in 63. End of 63, and went to Hong Kong as a China analyst in the early part of 64.
Now, did she go through the program with you?
No. They were, the State Department didn't train wives.
Mm-hmm.
But she took training from our teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Because she didn't want to go to Taiwan, which was the second half of the program, and run a household without being able to speak the language. And so she did that at her expense. And then when we got to the field school in Taichung, she was given some training. So she ended up fluent in the language, but without being able to read or write.
Mm-hmm. This is Mandarin.
Yeah. And we went to Hong Kong, got to Hong Kong in 1964, and I was working in the mainland section, and I was an analyst for domestic affairs. It was very quiet, but I wanted to work on domestic affairs because there I could use your Chinese, and I could learn about this strange country with whom we had no relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And as luck would have it, at the end of 65, the Cultural Revolution broke out. And at that point, I was kind of the senior working level China analyst in the China mainland section. And so what was originally a sort of a quiet scholarly job turned into the central focus of the whole mainland section. Mm-hmm. I went from writing a learned dispatch every week to writing a telegram every day, mm-hmm. With the consul general looking over my shoulder and approving everything. So this was luck, you know. That's the luck.
Timing.
The luck of history, the luck of
and
the draw.
Talent.
What?
Timing and talent.
Well, the timing was there, and I was able to turn it to good advantage. Mm-hmm. And that led to my being named sort of the head China watcher in the U.S., in the State Department, starting in 1969. Mm-hmm. Went back, did a stint on the China desk, then moved into INR and would sort of ran the analysis on China. And of course, at that point, the focus was all on Sino-Soviet tensions, mm-hmm. up along the Russian border, up along the Soviet border. And of course, those tensions, which became very, very severe, led to the opening, that plus in 69, the assumption of, by Richard Nixon of the presidency, and he was predisposed to opening to China, as he had already more or less announced, mm-hmm. led to the opening and to the secret Kissinger trips and then to his historic trip. And I, in the meantime, had gotten so sick of Chinese affairs that I had asked the personnel people, I mean, I'd been doing nothing else but for 10 years, and very intensely. So I asked them for a broader job. I said, you know, let me have a better look at the State Department. Let me have a better look at the Foreign Service. I said, okay, you have a decent record. We'll put you to work in the Secretary of State's office. And I was in the Secretariat staff, which makes sure that the Secretary's needs during a particular day get taken care of. The mm-hmm. briefing papers are done, and he knows who he's seeing, and he knows what to say to them, and so forth. And it's sort of the central point where the political part of the State Department and the bureaucracy come together. And I thought that was a great idea for an assignment, and I enjoyed it mm-hmm. a lot. But the lucky thing was that when Nixon came time for Nixon to travel to China, mm-hmm. the secretary, of course, had to go with him mm-hmm. because the secretary always travels with the president. Rogers hadn't had much to do with the opening of China at that point. Nobody was really even sure that he approved of it. But he had to go, and someone had to do briefing papers and do all the things, and so Rogers, in his good sense, said, "Well, is there anybody in my organization here, my immediate organization, knows anything about China?" Oh, they said, "Yeah, there's a guy, and he speaks the language and he knows the issues, and he's been working on China for years." And so Rogers invited me, uh-huh. after interviewing me, to be his private secretary for the purpose of this trip. Wow. And to help him pull together all the papers and so forth. And that led to, I mean, that was like going to the Olympics and winning a gold medal for a young Foreign Service officer.
Right.
Or not even a not so young Foreign Service officer, but for a China specialist, etc. Mm-hmm. And it gave me a sort of a seat amongst the pioneers, and it led to going to open up the liaison office when we, 14 months after Nixon's trip, began to have a resident office in Beijing. Mm-hmm. And so I had to leave Beijing early, mm-hmm. Because I ran into a young woman on a bicycle and she died. And that was what I thought was the end of a rather promising China career. Mm-hmm. David Bruce, who was our senior diplomat and who was head of the liaison office
there.
And the Chinese told me, look, in cases where diplomats have fatal automobile accidents, they invariably leave the country of their own accord. And I said, I thought, well, that's that. But I said, of course, I'll do that. And it was, in fact, what their policy was. It wasn't aimed at me, and it wasn't aimed at U.S.-China relations. It was just their way of doing things.
Sure.
So I said goodbye to David Bruce, and he said, this is not the end of the world. This is going to be very good for your career, because it's going to force you to branch out and do more things. And I had wanted to go to Japan. I'd have put into Japan for Japan language and assignment before I went to Beijing. And now I could do both, even though the circumstances were not ones of my choosing. So our family went off to Japan, where we stayed for 4 years, and where we had a very interesting and friendly and positive time. That's where we met the Armacosts, well, caught up with the Armacosts and others. And I, we love Japan, and everybody, the Japanese were interested in China. Part of my job was to follow China from Japan with the Japanese, compare notes, and so forth. And it was a compelling time for U.S. policy because the our defeat in Vietnam occurred at that time. Japanese were very curious about that. Then, then the Carter administration came along and wanted to pull troops out of Korea, and that upset the Japanese even more. But I got to know their foreign policy, and I got to know, I came out of that Japanese experience sort of fully qualified Asia hand. I could deal with policy towards Southeast Asia, Japan, China, etc. And as luck would have it, and again, luck, you never know, I knew Richard Holbrooke as a young Foreign Service officer, and he was a even younger Foreign Service officer. And he came to Japan with Mondale in 1977, the first trip that the Carter administration took overseas, and they went to Japan. And I managed the trip. I mean, I had been, I'd gotten quite experienced at these big trips. And I had also managed Gerry Ford's trip to Japan. And when Mondale came, it was a piece of cake. And I was interested to see Holbrooke again and to, you know, see what Mondale was like and how this new administration was going to relate to Asia. Well, sitting in the Okura Hotel with Richard Holbrooke, and he's unpacking, and we're shooting the breeze about the new appointments in the Carter administration, their approach to Asia policy, etc. And Holbrooke says, my God, I've forgotten my pants. He had khakis on, you know, and informal things. But he was going to go see the prime minister in 20 minutes. And he says, you know, by any chance, have a suit around that I could wear. And being a, you know, experienced FSO, control officer, etc., etc., I had a room in the hotel, and I had an extra suit, because I wasn't going to wear the suit the whole day, the whole time. If you're traveling, you may have to do that, but if you live there, you don't. So I was roughly the same size as Holbrooke, and I lent him my suit, and he wore it the whole time I was there. And as luck would have it, I gave him some idea that perhaps I was a person of some use. So that led to me being appointed at a very tender age, the officer in charge of Japanese affairs in the State Department, which was about two levels above my pay grade. But Holbrooke was the youngest assistant secretary in the history of the State Department, and he was a person, a very strong personality, and he got his way. So I went back and I worked for him as head of the Japan desk for a year. And then I went over to work for Brzezinski. Mm-hmm. Holbrooke liked to run the interagency process by putting his own people in jobs in other agencies. You've got time. I mean, this is taking more time than you want.
No. I want to make sure it's all good. Yeah.
Anyway.
Please.
So he said he... So I, and at that point, Armacost is in the National Security Council, and Abramowitz is in the Defense Department, and Abramowitz is appointed to go to Thailand as ambassador, and so Armacost moves to defense, and I move to the NSC and work for Brzezinski. I do that for a year and a half. And then Armacost is, they want to bring Armacost back to the State Department to run, to be the principal deputy to Holbrooke. So I go to work for Harold Brown for a year. By the time I'm finished with all of this, I've had a look at every agency in the national security, in the national security apparatus, and it's taken me right through the Carter administration, and things have happened. All kinds of things have happened. We've normalized relations with China. We've started the military-to-military relationship with the Chinese. And I'm the one who helps Harold Brown do that. Mm-hmm. And so this is a very good series of jobs. It gives me a very good look at Washington as a whole. Then, of course, Carter is not reelected. Mm-hmm. And I am... wondering what my fate is going to be. And as luck would have it, the person in charge of the transition team in the new Republican lashup is Rich Armitage, who comes to see me, and I ask him whether I have a chance of staying on in my current job. And he says, no. There's someone in the Republican incoming group that really wants that job, and it's me. So I say, well, fine. Thank you for being straight with me. I'll go try and find a job in the State Department. He said, we'll help you. You have a good reputation as a professional, not as a politician, but as a professional. And you can be of assistance to some of the new guys over there. And there weren't any jobs in East Asia, but there was a job in International Organization Affairs. Mm-hmm. And I found myself working for Elliot Abrams, who was another very young Assistant Secretary of State, in this case for International Organization mm-hmm. Affairs. So I go to work as his kind of professional Foreign Service officer, gunslinger, as a deputy assistant secretary, and help him plan his time and decide what his priorities are. And you know, in those days, International Organization Affairs, UN Affairs, etc., were the work of the specialized agencies in Geneva, and they in New York, it was mainly cleaning up after the Israelis or the South Africans. And as far as policy, creative policy was concerned, all of the work was in Africa, was in relations between South Africa and the frontline states, Zambia and and in Namibia and Angola and so forth. Mm-hmm. And our job was to try and get the South Africans to withdraw from Angola and from Namibia. So I said to Elliot Abrams, that's what you should work on, because that's what's fun. The other stuff is a lot like work. And he took my advice, and he developed a very good relationship with Chester Crocker, who was then the Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, and stayed in that job for 8 years.
Wow.
And a very talented man. Elliot himself was moved on very quickly because he had a very strong record in human rights, and they wanted an Assistant Secretary for Human Rights. The Reagan administration didn't want to be seen as the only administration to come in that had not appointed a person in that position. So there goes Elliot. And so I become Assistant Secretary Acting for International Organizations Affairs. And I then start working with Chester Crocker, and we have a great time together, traveling around trying to muscle the South Africans into leaving and Angola and ultimately Namibia, and having relations with a lot of different African states and so forth. So,
very different part of the world.
Very different part of the world, but I found that my muscles worked for that part of the world quite well. And one day Crocker calls me up and he says, you know, Frank Wisner's coming home to be my Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, or Deputy Assistant Secretary. Would you like to be Ambassador to Zambia? I said, sure, of course I would. He said, I'm looking for someone who can do not just the bilateral stuff, but also be my guy in the region and help me and avoid my having to go out there every time any little thing happens. So I spent 2 years as ambassador to Zambia, and they were very interesting 2 years. And Zambia at that point, Lusaka was the Geneva of the region, because Kenneth Kaunda was the head of state who said anybody's welcome to come here and talk, as long as they behave, as long as they don't do stupid violent things. And so the South Africans came, and the Angolans came, and Namibians were there, and Swapo, and all those characters, and it was a very interesting place to be. So I traveled all over the region, well, South Africa itself, and Zimbabwe. I got to know Mugabe when he was the golden-haired boy, if that's the right word, for the whole region, brand new, etc., etc. He was actually quite impressive in those days. But anyway, so I was now an ambassador. I had cut my teeth on an ambassadorial post that was quite manageable, not too big, not too small. And then the telephone rings, and it's Charles Hill, who had worked for me in Hong Kong on domestic affairs, learned Chinese and so on and so forth. And he is, after having gone through a whole variety of interesting jobs working for very powerful people, he is now the Executive Secretary of the State Department and the Special Assistant to George Shultz. And he said, you know, I can't do these two jobs. These two jobs are too much for one person. And if you'd be interested in coming home to work as the executive secretary, I will arrange for you to meet Mr. Shultz. And I'd been in Zambia for 2 years, and it was time to move on to something else. Hold on a minute.
No problem.
Can we stop this? Hi, I'll call you right back. I'm in a meeting. Okay, bye.
Problem.
I'm sorry to bore you with all this detail.
No, this is wonderful.
But this is the way things happen.
Yeah.
Right? And personally, it was time for me to go home. My sister was dying of cancer, and I wanted to go home. And so I did. I went and I saw George Shultz, and he said, after we talked for a while, that, you know, I had experience in the Secretariat before, and I had experience in other parts of the world and other agencies and so forth. So he said, come work for me. But the conditions are that you only work here for 2 years, because this is very intense. And after 2 years, you'll go on to something else. Because you'll be toast, you know. And he was right. I mean, there was 2 years of getting to work at 7 a.m, going home at 9, and sometimes later, working for 5 hours on Saturday and 3 hours on Sunday. And the only time I saw my wife was on Wednesdays for lunch. And I said to myself, I'm gonna make that a sacrosanct occasion. We'll have lunch together every week. We'll see each other in the early morning and the late night, but we'll have lunch together every Wednesday. So we survived this, and it was a very difficult time, very interesting time. Shultz was a marvelous man to work for. And he didn't care that I'd worked in all kinds of these positions in the Carter administration and so forth. The different parties and the different foreign policy people, political people who come in are really just interested in whether you can do the work or not. They're looking for people to help them. They're looking for people who can do the work. And Shultz was very good at using his pros. And he gave me access to every meeting he had with other people in the department. So I was known as someone who really had close-in access to him. And that enabled me to serve him a lot better, because I was there when these decisions were made. And we went through all kinds of stuff, Iran-Contra and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But when my two years were up, I had made it mine and Charlie Hill's task to convince George Shultz that it was his idea that I should go to the Philippines as ambassador. Because we've been through the transition together in 86. This was 87, and my time was up. And I thought, that's a job I'd really like to have. Big job, working for a new democratic government, courageous lady, head of state, et cetera, et cetera. And Shultz thought this was a very good idea of his to send me there. And so I found myself ambassador to the Philippines for almost 4 years. And very, very roller coaster, up and down, horrible natural disasters, horrible man-made disasters, coup attempts, earthquakes, volcanoes, huge mission, huge American community. I really learned the hard way how to lead and how to make decisions, even though you have instantaneous communications and so forth, but when your time difference is 12 hours, you don't want to wake everybody up every time. And I survived that. And we negotiated a base agreement, and which was subsequently repudiated by the Filipinos, but I succeeded in doing what the government wanted me to do, and I supported her, and we went through all kinds of things together, traveled around the country a lot. My wife was extraordinarily important to me, both because she was a psychiatric social worker and could help me work the community at a time when they were under huge stress. Anyway, I was coming to the end of my career. I had one more ambassadorship left in my in me, I think, and I asked what they wanted me to do, and they said, the they being be at that point being Bush Senior and Jim Baker. And they said, we think you should go to Pakistan as ambassador. Oh, I said, why? I mean, I know there's a China link with Pakistan, but it's not part of the day-to-day stuff of policy or diplomatic operations. Oh, they said, well, you have a good track record for supporting lady heads of government in weak democracies. Oh, I said, but let me just make 3 points. One is I'll go happily, because I want to go to South Asia. It's very rare that a person gets a chance to serve in Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, and South Asia in one career. And but supporting lady heads of government in struggling democracies is not a core Foreign Service skill. Point one. And point two, Benazir Bhutto and Cory Aquino are two entirely different people. And I just don't know whether the chemistry will be there. I just don't know if it'll work. But don't worry, I'll go and see what happens. So I get to Pakistan at the end of 1991.
What city were you based in?
Islamabad was the capital.
Yeah, okay.
And it's a little bit like it is now. The military is out of power. They want to stay out of power. Various parts of the government, elements of the central government are pretty weak and very much in contention with each other, etc. But anyway, I was very interested to be in Pakistan. The war in Afghanistan was coming to an end. We had just withdrawn all assistance to Pakistan because they had developed a nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. That was our reason. They said, that's not your reason. Your reason is because Soviet Union has collapsed and you don't need us anymore. And you're just discarding us like a used something or other. Well, it was a hard time to be ambassador, but it was a good time because I didn't have anything to give them. All I could do was show up. And the Pakistanis wanted me to show up. They wanted a relationship with the U.S. Well, as luck would have it, the phone rings one day. I've been there for 6 months. And it's the Board of Trustees of the Asia Society. And they say, we want you to come back and be the president of Asia Society. This is a job that comes around only once every 10 to 12 years. And you only have a year left in your assignment, really, in Pakistan, and perhaps you'd think of doing this. Well, I thought that was a good idea. I'd like to do that. But I'd only been there for 6 months. And I couldn't just down tools and say, hey, I'm off to a nice job, goodbye. So I said to the Asia Society, look, all that a president can do is expect his ambassadors to stick around until the election time. That's all that they can expect. Mm-hmm. So if you can wait for me for 7 more months, I will come, I will commit to come and do this. Mm-hmm. And I will then explain this to President Bush, and that'll be that. And so they did agree, and so I only stayed in Pakistan for a year and a month. But I told them that I would use the Asia Society as a platform for better relations with Pakistan, and I did that. Mm-hmm. But it was a perfect retirement job, very, very demanding, required all kinds of travel and all kinds of variety, because the Asia Society is, compared to the government, a small organization, but it does culture and it does performing arts and visual arts and political policy seminars and economic seminars and business conferences and education programs for people trying to learn about Asia. In fact, it is a way for people to get educated about Asia. Mm-hmm. But it's a good job for me, and I want it, and I'll do it. And so I did it.
You have the experience, certainly.
So that's kind of the thumbnail of the career. Now, I've written this all down. Mm-hmm. And there's a book called China Boys, mm-hmm. which I've given to SAIS. Mm-hmm. And you may have seen, I don't know, but it should be in the library, because it's really kind of a how-to narrative. Mm-hmm. For people who are interested in foreign service, and how this focuses on China, but it shows you how a combination of, you know, enthusiasm and passion and luck can lead to a decent career. Mm-hmm. I recommend that mm-hmm. book.
That's great.
I recommend that book to anybody who. And I hope SAIS buys a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. We absolutely will. And what is it, and what are you doing currently? I see your emails up behind you, and we're in your office space. And
well, I wrote the book here, mm-hmm. and I'm a consultant. Mm-hmm. I have a few clients. I need to go to China every 6 months in order to just keep up with the place, because it's changing so fast. And the language changes, and you know, you just got to. If I remain deeply interested in where it's going, and what it's going to do, and how we're going to relate to it, and I think it's, and that's my passion. And so, I have one of my clients is the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I was responsible for the management of Eugene Ormandy's first trip to China, which was in 73. And I've had a link with the orchestra ever since. And it is one of those relationships that has meant a lot to both the Chinese and to Americans. Mm-hmm. And they want a new strategy for China. They want engagement in the provinces and so on and so forth. And I'm helping them to do that. That's one. And I have a client in China who is an entrepreneur and a businessman who is looking for contacts here, mm-hmm. and advice here. Mm-hmm. So those keep me busy, and I have found myself, ever since this book was published a year ago, constantly doing lectures on the subject of China then and now. And the subject of China then I deal with the home movies I took of the Nixon trip and life in the liaison office in Beijing and other parts of China during the months that we lived there. And then I transitioned to China now by giving them some readings from the book. Mm-hmm. And then we have a real focus on China now in a program that really focuses on their questions. Mm-hmm. Where are we going? What am I doing here? You know, so on and so forth. And I've given this lecture now to about 30 different audiences, mm-hmm. including ones of younger Chinese in Chinese universities, provincial cities, and people here, universities and clubs and so on. And I find people, I don't know if they're interested in the book, but they're certainly interested in the subject. Mm-hmm. And so I use it as a way of flogging my book.
That's great.
And that's all of that keeps me. I did one this morning. I did one yesterday morning at Fordham. I probably should do it someday at SICE. I've done it in in Washington at the Foreign Service Institute and the Association for Diplomatic Studies and Training, which published the book. Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, gigs stretching on into November.
That's great.
So it's sort of turned into something to do, but at some point I'm going to have to write another book. Because there's quite a lot of stuff that I have here in my archives that needs to be covered.
Yeah.
And writing books is extremely challenging and lonely work. But after I've exhausted this particular subject, I think I'll settle down and write another book.
Well, that's great. And given all, thank you so much for sharing that, and given your vast experience everywhere in the world, what looking at current students at SICE today, what advice would you have for them?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is find out what you really like, what you really want to do. Find some job that you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning and say, God, you know, to think they're paying me to do this. What you're really looking for is what your avocation is. Then you have to find out whether you're good at it. It's no good to have an avocation which you're not good at. And it's no good to be good at something that you don't like. And these are things that you can do in graduate school, and you can do in college, and so on and so forth. And finding out what you don't like or what you're not good at is just as important as training for a particular carefully thought out profession. Most people who get to graduate school have already set their camp for something. And for me, it was the Foreign Service in general. But I was able to shift what I liked and what I was good at quite easily. And of course the Foreign Service is a very varied career. And you don't have a job in a one place that lasts for very long, and you have to be flexible and able to move, able to do different things. You have a specialty within your field and so on and so forth, but you really have to be able to do almost anything, which is one of the good things about the Foreign Service. So I think it's really, I think it's very important to find out what you really like and what really interests you. Because, and then follow that with intensity. And because if you're doing something you like and are interested in and are good at, you're gonna do well. It's just gonna happen. There are a lot of people that I've seen in the Foreign Service and in other parts of the government who spend a huge amount of time psyching out what their next move is gonna be, and trying to be in the right place at the right time. And they end up being really quite unhappy and in many ways quite unsuccessful. The people who go after things that interest them with interest and enthusiasm usually find that they are in the right place at the right time. And as this happened to me, terrible things happen, which seem to throw huge obstacles into a career. But they can be dealt with too, and they're part of life. So I think you just have to try to enjoy what you're doing, mm-hmm. and do it as well as you can. And, you know, good things will happen.
Yeah. That's great. Well, thank you so much for your time today and sharing your stories and for all the wonderful work you are doing and have done for the world in the U.S. And
well, Zeiss was an important place to start out. Mm-hmm. And I keep up with Zeiss Nanjing. I never, you know, hadn't even been thought of when I went to Zeiss. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, there was a center at Bologna, which was brand new, mm-hmm. which makes me one of the original sort of fossils. Mm-hmm. But it's a great institution, and it's been well led over the years. I wish it well.
Thanks. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
So I'm going to turn this off.